Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Kel O'Neill, a UK-based counsellor, educator, researcher, and lived experience advocate specialising in eating disorders. Kel is the founder of Mental Health Bites, creator of the Eating Disorder Recovery Companion, and the curator of Voxed, Voices of Experience in Eating Disorders. Kel's work focuses on ethical, trauma-informed practice, challenging stigma, and bridging the gap between lived experiences and professional knowledge. I'm really excited to be sharing this week's podcast with you because it is all about the conference that is happening on the 13th of February. Kel is bringing together individuals from all different backgrounds and experiences to talk about their lived experience of eating disorders. And lived experience is not just a tick box exercise here, it is the full focus, which is absolutely incredible to hear, and I really hope that you can join us. I will be speaking as well, so it'd be lovely to have you there on the day. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Kel O'Neill. So it's so nice to have you on the podcast. How are you doing, Kel?
Doing all right. Really glad to be here and to be talking to you about the conference.
It is very, very exciting. Did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Absolutely. So my name is Kel O'Neill and I am a counsellor, trainer and researcher entirely in the area of eating disorders, and I am also the creator of the Eating Disorder Recovery Companion, which is an online guided self-help portal for people with eating disorders, and I am the founder of what we're here to talk about today, which is Vox, the Voices of Experience in Eating Disorders, which right now is an online conference. Who knows what it becomes in the future?
And do you know what I think, what is so exciting I was looking through the program before we started talking. There are so many people speaking, and I just think I can't believe it doesn't exist already, but I'm equally so glad that you are doing it and have made this incredible conference with such a variety of speakers as well.
Well, to start with, thank you. When we started planning the event, it kind of... So if we go all the way back to the beginning of this kind of being born, which was in 2021, obviously we're in the middle of the pandemic and it was Eating Disorders Awareness Week. And I was like, surely I can do something with my limited tech skills at the time. And so I ended up just putting out a call on my mailing list saying, hey, if people want to like come together and talk about what is important to them in the eating disorder arena at the moment, and I will, as much as I can, work to incorporate that in what I choose to prioritise in my work going forward, because I have been and kind of had started around there juggling quite a lot of balls and having to determine what I would give priority to. And so we did this online evening session. I think we had maybe a dozen people attend, and a lot of what came up in that was that people wanted spaces to have conversations, and that people felt that eating disorder education is quite inaccessible for a variety of reasons, be that cost or be that logistics, because it's like on the other end of the country, or be that because spaces felt very specific to specific groups of folks. So for example, like psychiatric conferences not feeling very helpful for maybe talking therapists like myself, or people with lived experience only feeling included in conferences as kind of a sort of a ring fenced lived experience presentation as part of the event, rather than feeling actually part of it. And at that point, I actually didn't decide to do very much with that knowledge, and kind of sat on it and was delivering more workshops with online events, which is who is hosting the conference. And we kept talking in the in-between space, in between the workshops that we were doing together, kept talking about the need for lots of the conversations I was having in private to have more of an integrated way to kind of show those, and also some discomfort in me, to be honest, that I'm running all of these workshops. I'm like, I'm just me. I just have my opinions and my experiences, and I would like other people to be sharing them as well, and wanted a way to platform that too. And John at Online Events was like, Kel, let's do it. And I was like, oh, okay. So what I kind of anticipated when I said yes to this about a year ago was that we would do a one-day session with maybe four or five speakers. That was the intention. And I put out the call, and all I did was post it on my Instagram and my LinkedIn saying, this is a thing I'm trying to put together. Please submit if you're interested in speaking, as you know. And we were just overwhelmed with the amount of people that submitted. And I'd kind of put it as open as possible to be as inclusive as possible. There's quite a bit of information there to kind of go through and figure out what it was going to look like. But it quickly became apparent that if we really wanted to do what we were setting out to do, we wanted to platform as many people as possible. And so we figured out what basically the maximum amount of parallel sessions we could run would be with the tech team that Online Events have. And so we said, okay, we can run four streams, so we can run four times as much sessions as we plan to, and let's make the day a little bit longer as well, so we can fit in an extra four that way as well. So this kind of, like, I imagined that maybe we would have like 50 people attend, and we would have like five or six speakers, including myself, has turned into, I believe we've got over 30 speakers and 28 sessions, something like that, which is kind of mad. And I've had so many people approach me saying, thanks for doing this, this is so exciting, which I'm really glad about, because there is other eating disorder conferences. There's other great eating disorder conferences. But I and the people that came to my conference, not my conference, my EDOR session in 2021, said they wanted this space. And so here we are. I guess we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's amazing. And just by the fact of, you know, the fact that you had so many submissions and so many people that are speaking, it shows just how much we need it and how much people value it. And I do think it's really interesting, because in the different places that I work, but on the different projects, there definitely seems to be at the moment a big pull for lived experience. And I think maybe a year ago, it almost felt like a tick box exercise of like, oh, we have to have a lived experience individual because we have to. Whereas I don't know, as a lived experience individual myself, I feel so much more valued over the past, I would say, year to 6 months, of people actually really want to hear what you've said to inform their practice, as well as other people with lived experience to kind of resonate and feel less alone.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot more, what do I want to call it, bravery in this last year or so, of people who have lived experience themselves that are doing the work in whatever that means, if that's in education or research or clinically, or doing something cool like running a podcast, and coming forward and saying, hey, I'm in recovery or I'm recovered or I'm experiencing this thing. I also have these professional skill sets where I think if we were to go back not that long ago, it was very much the box, right? Not just the tick mm-hmm. box, but that the person with the lived experience was contained in their lived experience role mm-hmm. rather than being recognized as potentially having huge amounts of additional skills as well that can mm-hmm. elevate the work that they're contributing to.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've definitely recognized, I just feel more the skills that I have aren't just being able to say I had an eating disorder and this is how it impacted me. And it feels like the skills around that are being brought into the context as well. But I guess for people listening, I mean, from what I can see, it feels like the kind of general consensus is lived experience is not like a specific focus on a type of lived experience. But what sort of talks and stuff can people expect?
Yeah, so we have got a whole host of speakers. So the intention wasn't only to platform lived experience in the sense of people who have themselves had eating disorders, but to platform anybody with experience in relation to eating disorders. So be that clinicians who are working in different settings that maybe don't have the opportunity to share their clinical knowledge, or people working in specific niches like art therapy, let's say we have a speaker speaking on that, or parents, carers, family, all of the things, and kind of making a space where hopefully we all come together and it's kind of that we're all on equal footing, whether we're researchers, clinicians, people with lived experience, that are recovered or recovering, family members, whatever it might be, that we can kind of equitably and hopefully without any conflict in a polite, supportive, as safe mm-hmm. as possible way, have conversations that I guess ultimately my goal, I don't think this is going to be held within one conference, but ultimately my goal might be to be working towards having some of the needed difficult conversations in the eating disorder field that often historically, at least in my experience, have sat in those specific groups. So kind of clinicians coming to supervision, let's say, and talking about mm-hmm. the difficulties and aspects of the work, or people with lived experience going to their families and expressing what wasn't helpful to them about their treatment, but actually nothing ever being done in research with that, and kind of bringing it all together in a way that we've all got the same goal, right? I would hope. Mm-hmm. And so we need to all be having those conversations. And so we've got a solid mix. A lot of the people speaking have got lived experience. And because of both my audience and the audience of online events, a lot of the speakers are in the talking therapy realm, but not all of them. So we've got everything from your speaking, you're Kona Longan joining us. We have got a few researchers doing paper presentations on some of their work in, let me think, what have we got? We've got somebody from my research group talking about BMI thresholds in eating disorder research. We've got somebody talking about suicidality and eating disorders. And then we've got some more kind of creative type things like yourself. We've got somebody talking about art therapy. We've got some diverse perspectives in there. So the Black perspective on eating disorders, and we've got somebody talking about gender identity and eating disorders. We haven't by any means ticked all of the boxes, which would be wonderful if that was achievable, but it's just not possible. But I would like to think we've got a decent breadth.
Mm. And do you know what? I think that two things that you said are so needed within the eating disorder community. And I think that I'm hearing people say that we need it a lot more, but it's so nice to hear it actually being actioned. One thing is having the nuanced conversations that are difficult but needed. And I think I find doing the podcast, often I feel like I almost sit between, because I speak to clinicians. I also speak to people with lived experience. Clinicians so much want to be able to help and do their best for their patients, but particularly if they're working in the NHS, there's red tape, there's lack of resources, what have you. And yep. then patients are getting frustrated because they're not getting access to the care. And I'm just yep. like, can't we all just talk to each other and realize that you both want the same yeah. thing? It's just you know, whether it's systemic or organizational, what have you. But I think coming together and being able to have those conversations, while it's difficult, if you're open-minded and able to kind of discuss those things, can be fantastic. And equally, you know, I think that the conferences I've been to for eating disorders, as you said, you know, there's some fantastic conferences out there. But often the ones that I've been to more recently, it feels like if there's kind of like a big topic that everyone's focusing on at the moment in eating disorders, or something, you know, we're all at the moment talking about neurodiversity, which is fantastic, don't get me wrong, but there's still areas of research going on. There's still other minority groups. There's still other things that we, you know, could raise awareness of. I think that's what you've done so well, is you've got a complete breadth of topics, and that means that there's something for everybody there, and somebody's like the education around every aspect as well, rather than it being focused on one thing when it's calling itself kind of a broad conference.
Yeah, I'm really glad that that's translated, because I guess that was the intention. But you don't know sometimes what you're putting out reflects what you think it's putting out. And I know some people had asked me, particularly folks when we put out the call for speaker submissions, were like, is there a theme? What's the topic? And I left it as open as possible. But we did end up coming up with a slogan, and I've actually in the post today, so this is the first time talking about this, in the post today received a mug. We're going to be having a mug for the conference, which will be going live on social media today, with the conference slogan on, which is shared knowledge is shared power. Mm-hmm. And really, I think that's where I want to sit with all of it, rather than, like you say, it happens with Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and it happens with the kind of like flavors of the month, or maybe longer than that, maybe annually, kind of flavors that we focus on, right, in the eating disorder arena. And I think I've seen that, I've been around for about 20 years now, which is terrifying, and I've seen that kind of go through cycles over the years of, okay, well, like we're talking about men's health needs in relation to eating disorders, or we're talking about eating disorders in relation to autism, or we're talking about a specific presentation of an eating disorder. And it's kind of gone through the motions a few times enough that I'm kind of left thinking, okay, this is great and I'm glad that we're having conversations, but has anything changed? And I don't think a lot has changed in the 20 years that I've kind of, going back 20 years, I would have been in services myself then, and not a lot has changed in that time, other than hopefully I think people, particularly folks with lived experience, are being more vocal about that of late.
Why do you think there hasn't been that change?
I think some of it is finances, because this isn't everything in the world at the moment to some degree to do with financial based constraints. But I also think in part it's because people don't come together and have these conversations. I think sometimes when I share a piece of knowledge that I've developed in one aspect of my work in a different area of my work, people will say, oh, that's so interesting, I'd never even thought about that before. And you think, well, if only these two groups of people were speaking together, because I've heard that 100 times before. And I think these types of spaces haven't been available, or if they have been available, they haven't necessarily been as open, supportive, safe as they could be for those conversations to be had. Whether or not we've achieved that, I guess we will find out on the 13th of February. But yeah, I think some of it is about also the nuance and the complexity, right? Is that it's really hard in a 30-minute presentation of anything to cover anywhere near an ounce of the depth of complexity that comes with eating disorders. And I don't know how many people in your audience are talking therapists, but certainly in my professional arena, people are really discouraged from working in eating disorders, kind of, you know, leave it to the specialists kind of thing. And so lots of people that don't intend to be specialists just don't engage with this as a topic particularly, which I'm also hoping, by kind of removing some of the boundaries, be that cost boundaries or been at the types of ways folks are presenting at Voxed, or be that just it's recorded so people can access it whenever they want, and maybe they can feel more comfortable than going to a specialist conference than they would as a non-specialist. You know, you kind of end up with those fears of like, oh no, I'm going to ask a daft question. Mm-hmm. That maybe more people will feel open to engaging with learning more about eating disorders, because I think eating disorders is in the media a lot more now than it was 20 years ago. But I think it's so superficial, right? It's just the same types of headlines and the very edges of the knowledge, and not complexity, because complexity is complex. That's horrendous English.
I don't know if it's also an aspect of, you know, what you were saying about people are told, oh, just leave eating disorders to the specialists. I think, and you'll know more about this than me, but particularly when it comes to eating disorders, I get the impression that there's almost a fear of doing something wrong, saying something wrong, and, you know, sometimes avoiding the elephant in the room because you don't know how to approach it or you don't know what to say. And I wonder if in that sense, that's why there hasn't been so much change, because people... I do think in the 6 years that I've done this podcast, the one thing I will say that has changed is when I first started, there was a handful of people that spoke openly about their experience, and they were always called on to share lived experience or, you know, share their insights into eating disorders. And I really like going to events now because there's such a broad range of people, not only, you know, people with lived experience, but their carers, loved ones, you've got researchers speaking, and it feels like the topics that are being brought are so much more diverse in comparison to when I first started and it was a handful of people talking about their experience of anorexia.
Yeah.
But what I do think is that the people that sometimes are leading the research are still the same people that have been doing it for the past 20, 30 years. And obviously they have great experience and great insights. But sometimes I think we need to shake things up a bit. And I'm not sure if the people that have been doing the research for 20, 30 years have the nuance that we necessarily need. And I do think that that is coming through. And I've been in meetings where, you know, people are kind of addressing that nuance and having those conversations, which is really exciting. But I wonder if that's another element of why we've seen less change, because we've kind of been like, well, this way we know kind of works, and we're so protective over looking after eating disorders because we don't want to do something to make it worse.
Yeah.
And that's maybe why.
Yeah. I guess that, in my mind, to some degree, that's kind of encapsulated in lots of the historical research being very medically based, right? Which I guess that's where lots of like health related research is bound to begin. But we can't contain eating disorders just in the medication or manualized approaches or in a psychiatry box. It needs all of the complexity that exists in a living human. And I think are starting to see a lot more, for example, qualitative research, where we're having more of the detailed conversations about eating disorders, and hopefully that's going to continue, and hopefully maybe we have this conversation a few years from now and we're saying things have moved on a lot more, and if I can be a little part of that, then I'll be thrilled to be, and I think you're part of that too.
Yeah. And I mean, that makes me think of, I guess, another aspect of it, and what I think you've done so well with the conference is, traditionally, I think, you know, we can be quite closed-minded as to the different types of treatment that are available for people with eating disorders, or almost what recovery can look like for people from an eating disorder. And, you know, just as an example, when you were explaining the talks, you were talking about art therapy. And I think that along with the kind of like medical model of eating disorders, there's a realization now that eating disorders don't just impact you physically, or they don't just impact you mentally. I think often it's kind of like you see it as one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like there's a shift to a much more holistic approach to treating eating disorders and understanding the impact of them in terms of your relationships, your life, your job. Like, it touches every single aspect, which I think is then, you know, when you are doing a conference like your own, you need to have such a broad variety of conversations. And I think when I looked at the program, there's a talk about relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, those sorts of conversations in very open environments is so important. I remember doing a podcast way back when I started about sex and intimacy. And I remember being like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm talking about this. Like, this mm-hmm. is a sort of podcast, but it impacts it. And I think being yeah. able to have those conversations openly also then allows somebody to go into, you know, when they're getting support and say, yeah, this is something that I actually do need help with because my eating disorder is impacting it.
Yeah. I think that's part, right, of you referenced a little while ago about this historical tendency in like lived experience presentation to be showing basically like the narrative of skinny, white, affluent anorexia presentations. And actually when we recognize that it affects all different types of people and right across the lifespan and so on, more of these types of topics become more relevant. Because if we're talking about 13, 14, 15 year old girls, then I could see why we historically might have not included a conversation like that as part of a program. But actually what I hope we know now is that eating disorders can affect people any stage in their life and can affect any type of person. And so going back to what I said before, anything that's part of your human experience, anything that's part of living can be and is impacted in the lives of people with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so we have, I think we have two sessions. I think we have one on families and we have one more that's more on relationships in terms of kind of like closer romantic friendship based type relationships as well, because it's all impacted, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in my experience, I don't think there's a single thing that wasn't impacted. But I think it's so interesting when you come out of when I'm quite far along in my recovery, it's that realization of holy shit, I didn't realize how much it was impacting me. Like, I remember speaking to one of my friends the other day and she was like, do you know what? It's just so nice hanging out with you now because you laugh so much. You're so engaged. It's just, you know, I loved you before, but you're a very different person now. And I was just sat there like, that's so interesting, because I thought that I was just mm-hmm. breezing through life. No one recognized that I was unwell and this, that and the other. And you then come out of it and you're like, you know, every single interaction was being affected because there was that voice in my head constantly. And, you know, yeah. every event that you go to, you've got that critic telling you to do this, don't do that. So I think that's one thing I've definitely thought about in recovery is when you're in it, you don't quite realize it's impacting every inch of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think something I learned in my own journey, which I've actually been having some conversations about quite recently, was that when I thought I was recovered quite far down the journey and I was kind of symptomatically recovered and I was talking about being in a better place with my relationship with food and my body, actually lots of things beyond that still hadn't improved. Mm-hmm. And so I've been talking and sharing my own lived experience story in different ways, but going back to, I guess, being like 22 and I'm nearly 40 now. And I was saying at that point that I was recovered. And what I meant was I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do in terms of like sticking to a meal plan and so on. Mm-hmm. And then a few years down the line from that, as I started to train to be a therapist and I looked at more of the complexity of it, I started to say, oh no, this is recovery. And then more recently in asking people in my life, they were like, no, you were like 30 before you were in a place where we were like, no, it's definitely something that's behind her. And that last 8 years was not about my relationship with food or my relationship with my body. It was about my sense of self, my confidence, my ability to be authentic, to laugh more, to not be as concerned about how I came across to people. And that's all part of the process, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the stage I'm in now, is that stage of learning who you are and being okay with who you are without the eating disorder. And I find it such a complex thing because it's knowing, do I want to go out to that social occasion because I feel like I have no friends and therefore feel bad about myself? Or am I just tired and I want to stay home and I want to enjoy the evening by myself? And I think not having the eating disorder, because as we said, it impacts everything. So it's not just impacting you, you know, you shouldn't eat that or you should eat that. It's impacting your social events, your work, like everything. Mm-hmm. It just makes those decisions for you. And I think with the addition of ADHD, that decision paralysis and the inner critic, like that for me, I feel like is where I'm at now and is a point of recovery I wasn't expecting. I thought it would be the food stuff, tick, okay, now we go live our life and thrive, and I'm definitely doing a lot better, but it's, I don't think it's spoken about as much in that, almost like that redefining or finding, I guess, yourself.
Yeah. And I think that's part of why I chose to be a counsellor rather than any other type of professional when I went back in my mid-20s to train to work more directly with people with eating disorders rather than working simply in eating disorders, if you like. There would have been, you know, a few different avenues I could have taken with that. But the thing that I've found kind of holistically most helpful is quite traditional talking therapy. Mm. And a lot of the reason that people come to me now in my private practice is often, okay, well, I've got a meal plan, but I've been sticking to it for the last 6 months, a year, 3 years, however long it might be. And my life still feels small and rigid and restricted and contained by an eating disorder that apparently I'm recovered from, like, help. And that's part of why a lot of the speakers at the conference are folks who work in the counselling and therapy arena, because for me it's important to platform that actually we have really useful skills in terms of eating disorder recovery, that if we were only looking about that traditional lens that we were talking about before in terms of medical models and kind of like gold standard eating disorder care wouldn't even be included as part of the picture.
Which I think is maybe the reason why a lot of people don't often think it's part of the picture, because the treatment that we're so, like, you know, we're given a standard is that medical model of a meal plan, getting you up to a certain weight. It's very kind of, you know, are your blood parameters okay? It's not like finding your identity, discovering who you are. Probably from a resource and funding perspective, but I would argue that is equally as important. I know the medical aspect and getting you stable and everything is obviously very important, and I'm not denying that in the slightest, but if you're then just stuck in this awkward in between of, well, I don't have an eating disorder, but I don't know who the hell I am, and I think that's potentially where relapse can happen, because it's like, well, I'm not, what's the point in being here? Like, I might as well just go back to my eating disorder, where at least I felt safe, if that's a word you want to use, because I don't like it here.
Yeah. I think lots of people talk about, don't they? And I'm sure you've had conversations on the podcast about this. Lots of people talk about in that kind of what I might now refer to as early stages of recovery, as actually being harder than living with the eating disorder, because you're attempting to choose to engage with life and you've largely taken away the behaviors that you were using to cope that were part of your eating disorder, but actually you haven't built up your sense of self enough to be, I hate this word, but resilient enough to deal with everything that inevitably adult life will throw at you. And so of course, living in that place, certainly I was keeping my life very small compared to where I am now, which sometimes I shoot myself in the foot because I do too much and take on too many things. I'm still at heart an introvert. But if you'd told, let's say, 25-year-old me, who was raring to go to start her counselling practice, that I would be here 15 years later, I'd be like, oh, I can't imagine that. I'm good. I'm fine here where I am, which I guess is also an important message for us to share, right, as we continue to move beyond that, like, medical definition of recovery, that's also part of this nuanced conversation.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The more that I step into my own recovery, the more I'm realizing that it looks so different for everybody, and you can have I spoke about this on a podcast the other day, actually, and I was a guest rather than on Full of Beans. And they said to me something about, you know, how did you stay motivated in recovery? And I was kind of like, I have no idea. But I tried to think about the times when recovery hadn't worked and then thought about the time this time that recovery had. I felt that the difference was when I was in recovery before, people would say to me, what do you want to gain from recovery? And I'd have these big ideas like I want to have children or I want to go traveling or I just want to be free of this eating disorder. And it felt so abstract. And I don't think deep down I did really want to have children. And I don't think I did really want to be free from the eating disorder. But the time that I did feel that recovery was successful, it was literally the day-to-day activities, like my friend being able to cook me dinner or being able to go out and feel nice in the clothes that I was wearing. And the more that those things happened, the more it motivated me to want them even more. And then I started to realize, oh, you know, recovery doesn't just mean being able to go out for brunch. Like recovery means completely unrelated things to food. And it's kind of just not having that inner critic all the time or not having that food noise all the time. But for me, I didn't feel like I could know what I wanted from recovery until I was almost in it already, if that makes sense.
I think if you ask somebody, and maybe this is me speaking as a therapist more than it is from my own experience, because it feels like so long ago now. But if you ask somebody in those beginning steps, you're kind of projecting right into what you think a future is supposed to be. So that might include like career aspirations or aspirations for children or financial aspirations. And again, that lacks the nuance of what living is. As a therapist, I kind of situate myself quite existentially, which for me basically just means that I focus a lot on purpose and meaning. And when you say that, sometimes that can sound similar to that like, okay, like I want the purpose of my life to be like something was different because I was here, which is like this big abstract thing, or I want the purpose of my life to be having children and bringing children up, which is like a massive step if you're on day one recovery from your eating disorder, instead of thinking about, okay, what do I experience as valuable in living? Is it my relationships? Is it certain types of experiences? Is it what do I value, and how do I start to build some of that into my life? And the way I talk about it with clients is, I don't want to work with you on fighting with the eating disorder. I want to work with you on strengthening you, because the more of you takes up your brain, the less space there is in there for your eating disorder. And so you have to, I guess, learn to inhabit more of life. But that feels impossible on that day one, right? So of course, it's this ever evolving and changing thing. I mean, certainly changed for me, and I'm sure will continue to change for me as I get older, as an ongoing think of like, what do I want from life right now? And then like asking yourself regularly, hey, because that might have changed, because 25-year-old me didn't want to like live with a big garden and a couple dogs and sit in her home office and chill out, which is like mostly what my life looks like now. You'd ask 25-year-old me, I was like, oh, I need to like travel the world, I need to like have millions of friends. I'm like, oh no, they're the aspirations I think I'm supposed to have based on what we're told is aspirational, based on and not based on what's aligned with my values and what I find purposeful and meaningful.
I mean, and I do wonder as well if that is almost something that happens with aging. Not like aging sounds like we're like 90, maybe mature.
I feel it sometimes.
Yeah, my knees do too. I do think that, you know, if I 18-year-old me, she did just want to impress everybody, whereas 28-year-old me, I think I'm more self-confident and I kind of don't feel like I need to do things to get the approval of others. And I also think something, you've just reminded me of something else that I found really helpful in my recovery as well, in terms of values. I sat down with myself one day and I was like, what do I value in life? Like, what's really important to me? And something that came up was like being a good friend and being a good partner. And I was like, whilst I'm engaging with the eating disorder, honestly, am I able to do that? And I couldn't say yes. And I suddenly thought, whereas I thought that this was safe and I thought that following these rules was making me a good person, it's distancing me from the people I love the most.
Yeah.
And I think that really helped me to then think, okay, I'm not just going to be recovered overnight, but what can I do to kind of work towards that? And I think the more that I stepped into the real true version of myself, I did then have the capacity to, or the more that I stepped away from the eating disorder, I had the capacity to like look after my friends. And I remember when one of my friends, she went through a breakup recently and I was around her house and I thought, I wouldn't have been able to do this a few months ago. I wouldn't have had the capacity to be the support that I'm being right now. I would have had to stay for half an hour and leave. Like, I wouldn't have been able to cook for her. I would have found it so triggering when she wasn't eating because she was crying so much. And that just was a real wake-up call to me of, oh, okay, like by not having the eating disorder, I can actually look after myself and other people. And just one other thing I wanted to say was what you were saying about there being more of you so that there can kind of be less of the eating disorder. I found it really helpful to think, almost to thank the eating disorder, of being like, thank you so much for protecting me when I didn't think that there was any other option, but I don't need you right now, or I don't need you anymore. And like, I'm really grateful, but it's okay for us to separate. And that, I had a therapy session on that. I remember crying so much. But it was just that sort of, I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's part of the process as well, right? Is dealing with the reality that, it certainly sounds like your experience and my experience too, was that my eating disorder developed at a time where I was maybe too young, or certainly didn't have, hadn't developed any capacity yet to deal with some deal with some cards that had been dealt. That was what I'm trying to say. And my eating disorder came along and certainly was a focus that kept me going. Yes, it was massively unhealthy, and yes, there are still kind of consequences of that in my life now. I guess there's some good things as well, because I wouldn't be doing this had I not had that experience. But in the cold, harsh, stark reality of the day, might I have not survived had I not have found a coping mechanism, however unhealthy it was. And very glad that it's not part of my life today too. But it serves a purpose, right? That's something that I also say to clients is that in the vast majority of instances, an eating disorder has some sort of functional purpose in the person's life. And if you take it away from somebody before they learn how to do that differently, then that's surely going to equal relapse, or it's going to be massively overwhelming and terrifying, and you're not going to want to go with it. And going back to something you said before about age, I do think some of it is age too, in that, you know, certainly when I was in the beginning of my eating disorder at 18 or 19, I was not thinking about life in the way I would think about life by the time I was moving into later stages of recovery. And I do see that in my client work as well. I do see that it's easier to work on a deeper sense of recovery with clients that have maybe got past their mid-20s, and kind of you look at life a little bit more differently, and it becomes less important to fit in a very specific way that we are I guess naturally inclined to want to do when we're younger. I think with age comes some sense of like, oh sod it, I'm just going to be myself, this is too much effort.
I definitely think that's true. And then I also think there's, on the flip side of then the changes that occur in your body hormonally, physically. You know, I think there's, I guess, no age in life where we're immune to eating disorders. But I think, yeah, I definitely have noticed a shift of maybe it feels like there's more to recover for now.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
That's a nice message.
Thank you so much for joining me. That was such a lovely conversation. Let's finish. I'll put all the details for Voxed in the show notes.
Wonderful.
But do you just want to share a few details for people about the conference, any key bits of information they should know?
Sure. So it is on Friday, the 13th of February, which as we're recording, this is exactly 4 weeks today, but I guess we'll be a little bit closer by the time this is out there. It can be booked. You're going to put all the links out, so it can be booked via your links. But if you're hearing this and you're thinking about it later, if you just whack Voxed eating disorders into Google, it will come up. The conference is entirely online and it is all day, running from 9 till 6:30. Obviously, there are some breaks in there, but it is running for that entire duration. Everything will be recorded. So if you find the schedule and you think, oh no, I really want to be in Hannah's session, but I also want to be in this other session that's at the same time, you'll be able to access via online events portal the recordings a little while after the conference. And you'll be able to then, therefore, in theory, watch all, I don't know, there must be like 20 something hours of content by the time it's all put together, I would have thought. And yeah, I think that, oh, the other thing I haven't mentioned is the kind of low cost nature of it. So one of the things that came up from those original conversations was that eating disorder conferences are so expensive. And for those listening that don't know, some of them can be like £500 for a day. So we've set it at a self-select fee of either £20, £37.50 or £50. Oh. So we're like a fraction of like maybe like less than 1% of the cost of some of the conferences that might be out there. And for that, you will have access to everything. So I think that's all the important things.
Amazing. Well, you're incredible. What you're doing is incredible. And just
thanks
from
so much.
Everybody in the community, thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.